name is Bear Siragusa, and you are listening to the Hunting Hound Podcast, presented by W Hunting Supply.
There we are. Paul Wilson, thanks for coming on.
No, thanks for having me back again.
Yeah, it was, that was maybe 6 months ago we did the last one.
Yeah, I guess it must be. Yeah, it was the beginning of the hunting season. So, yeah, for me anyway.
Yeah.
How's
your season?
Dreadful.
Really?
Yeah, really bad. We had a nice start, a really nice start. And then it all went pear-shaped after that. You know, we had probably the first 6 weeks, 2 months of the season when we start what we call staff hunting. So it's just me and the guys. Hound really, really rocking and rolling, just doing a really nice job. And then just dreadful scenting conditions, awful. All season has been just terrible.
Really? What makes, because you're based out of Virginia, what makes bad scenting conditions for you?
Primarily low humidity. That low humidity. Yeah. It's been a really, really dry winter and dry fall. I mean, a lot of the leaves and whatnot, because we've had very, very little moisture, the leaves haven't kind of rotted down in the wood.
Right.
Yes. So it's always difficult when you have scenting conditions. You know, you've got a pack of hounds going through and all they're doing is just stirring all the leaf litter up. It makes the scenting conditions pretty tough. I mean, the entire season has been just what I would describe as just picking away. You know, they're able to go on lines, but just have to just keep niggling. And for me, you know, there's days I take out, you know, like 35, 38 hounds.
Mm.
And they all have their unique abilities, but, you know, in amongst that dynamic, you've got hounds that have tremendous noses, really, really, really good deep scent noses. And then you've got ones that have tremendous drive that want to keep things going forward. So in ideal scenting conditions, it all works, like, because, you know, the ones that have got that drive kind of keep maintaining the ones with the better noses, and it all kind of run up together. And they always said back in the day that a good pack of hounds, you know, you should be able to throw a blanket over the top of them. You know, they should always be in one group. But this year, this season has just been me constantly trying to push the back end of the pack to the front end of the pack, because the front end's running away and the back end's just wanting to dwell. And there's that kind of sweet spot between the two. Mm. Where you want to try and push those slower hounds up to the front, so that when they're just sitting there and they're boo-hooing on, you know, like a cold scent, and it might necessarily be that was last night's scent. It was, I mean, the way the scenting conditions have been, we've had foxes running in front of them that have gone minutes, seconds.
Wow.
And they're struggling. You know, you're almost like the hounds are standing there looking as if you're lying to them, because they can't pick up that scent.
Right. Right.
So it's been incredibly rough. And then, you know, we went through that, and then Christmas, typically around Christmas time, even in years past when we've had poor fall seasons, generally by the time Christmas has come, we've had some moisture, if it's either snow or rain, and it's packed down the leaves and it's given a little bit of moisture on the ground. And generally, January and into February is generally a normally good periods of the season. You know, some of our best time, and especially normally foxes are breeding at that time of year as well. So you've got, you know, male foxes are coming in out of territory, so you normally get some really good runs. Blasting out of country because, you know, you got male suitors coming into the female. So, you know, you normally got, it's typically a good season. But this year we had torrential rain, and then frozen solid. Like, I mean, we had a bunch of days where it was 15 degrees, 20 degrees, right. And the ground was just frozen solid. So it's not safe to go out, certainly on the horses. And then when it's too wet, the farmers and landowners don't want it on the ground on the horses because you turn the ground up. And plus, you know, where do you park? You know, we have 30, you know, sometimes up to 30, 40 horse trailers. You know, you can't just park them in the field and then drag them all out with a tractor and ruin the guy's field, you know?
Right.
So it's been a pretty frustrating 2024 so far, because just between, you've had one extreme, it's either been frozen solid or it's been, you know, like a bog.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, we finally started the last couple of weeks. We finally started to, in February, we started getting a little bit better, but even then, it's kind of like driving with a handbrake on it. And I think it's just a little bit too little, too late now, you know?
Right.
It's kind of written off the season.
Sure. When does the season end for you?
We go until the 9th of March. I mean, we're already seeing yesterday, we had a nice day yesterday, and we put two foxes to ground within very, very short periods of time. And that's normally pretty indicative that it's vixens that are in cub.
Right. Was that, were those the videos you sent me yesterday?
Yeah.
That looked like a great day.
So we found two early on and both stayed up maybe 10 minutes and went straight to ground. Hmm. And they struggled on those first two, which is also normally pretty indicative that it's a vixen. I don't know what it is. I don't know whether it's a physiological thing or whatever it is, but generally this time of year when vixens are heavy in cub, they don't tend to give off an awful lot of smell.
Okay. Interesting.
I don't know whether that's a physiological thing or whether it's just, I don't know. It seems very, very typical that female foxes, when they're heavily, they just don't seem to carry a lot of scent. So we ran two and they didn't really go very far at all and went straight to ground. And typically my hounds will mark very, very strongly at an earth. And they were very nonchalant about it. They were like, yeah, it's gone in there, but yeah, whatever. No. Now, typically they're tearing at tree roots and, you know, they're pretty keen at an earth, but they both of these, the first two were just, because of, you know, yeah, you could tell undoubtedly it's gone in, but they were just meh, whatever, you know?
Right.
I had to kind of encourage them. I was like, kind of get them wound up a little bit and encourage them to mark a bit more. But, and then the temperature was rising at a crazy rate. It was getting warm. And I'm like, yeah, this is going to suck today. This is going to be hard, hard work, you know?
Right.
The first, and typically we don't find that many foxes. And I was kind of pretty fearful that after running two already, maybe they were the only two foxes in that immediate area and we could be completely skunked. But fortunately they weren't. And you saw the video. I mean, they actually did a really quite a nice job and I was dumbfounded considering how warm it had gotten, you know?
Hmm. So, gotcha.
Go figure. Whenever you think you have what you would imagine to be good scenting conditions figured out. Mother Nature says, nah, that's not how it is. Sorry.
That's the darndest thing, isn't it? Yeah. I was at this, the biggest organized hunt in Europe, which is, a fox hunt that they've got over here. And it's not like what you guys are doing over there, but it's where they break them up. You know, they break 500 hunters up into different smaller groups of like 15 to 20 people.
Right.
And then you've got dogs, you know, you've got hounds, maybe two, three hounds to a group.
Right.
Running fox to ground and then terriers for each group and things like that.
Okay.
Last year I went and it was just horrible conditions, pouring rain, and we got 23 foxes. All but two of them were for the hounds.
Right. Right.
This year the conditions were, I mean, just should have been perfect. Like 3 or 4 below, fresh snow.
Right.
And like after a long period of very, very, very cold. So we're like, you know, it's a couple days with good conditions. They're probably going to be out moving around. This is going to be great. And we got like everybody in total got 8.
Wow.
Only 2 of them were for the hounds. The rest of them were like layups, tossing terriers into dens that they knew were already there just to see if anybody was home.
Right.
So it, I mean, the scenting conditions, I still, and it's gratifying to, you know, read some of these books and listen to some of the old interviews that like Bruce did with some of those old guys way back in the day, with the dryland hunting, talking about scent conditions.
Yeah.
Where it's like, none of them ever felt like they totally figured it out, which is reassuring to me. Cause I have like, I feel like every time I feel like I start to get close, I kind of realize that it's not going to happen.
No, Northern English, the Yorkshire folk in England, they have a saying about scent and this, and it's nowt's a queer as a scent, nowt's a queer as scent except a woman.
Oh man, I love that.
I don't know if you get the gist of it, but yeah.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And it's entirely true.
Yeah.
The only thing more complicated is a woman.
No, only thing more complicated than scent is a woman. That makes, I love that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
So, you know, you said you've been spending kind of the season trying to keep the pack consolidated a little bit. Is that purely happening on like cold trailing versus fast trailing ability, or is that an age thing? Like what is it that's making, what plays into those pack dynamics? Because you're running a lot of hounds at the same time, so you've got kind of this coaching, I think of it a little bit like a coaching role, you know, whereas some of us are just like dropping dogs, you're actually having to, you know, approach them a little bit more like a football coach or a baseball coach would approach a team, like trying to get everybody pulling in the same direction.
It's very much that. I think it's a combination of both scent and abilities and ages as well. I mean, like right now I have an old dog there called Remus, and he was ended in 2016, I think. So he's getting up there. He's got a tremendous amount of miles on him now. When you consider how many miles we do, I mean, it's kind of like the sled dogs, you know, you think, you'd say, well, he's 8 or 9, and you think, well, crap, that's not that old. But when you think in terms of a foxhound or a sled dog, that's a hell of a lot of mileage on them, a hell of a lot. And he's getting up there, and he's always been one of those hounds that's been at the front end and at the business end of things. And I just noticed this later in the fall, earlier on in the season, I didn't notice it quite so much, but he can't quite run like he used to. And when he does, the next day, you can see he's visibly sore.
Visibly like tired, me. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of like me, really. So I noticed that. And, you know, there's one or two that I've what we call in the foxhound world, in the mounted foxhound world, we call draft. We draft a hound. So when they become at a point where they're too slow or they don't suit our purpose, then we draft them to another hunt. So I drafted actually 6 or 7 around just before Christmas for that very reason. They were just getting too slow. And I send them down to a lady down in South Carolina. She's in Pinewood Forest, and it's sandy soil. Mm-hmm. So it's not so tough on the hound's bodies, you know, or on the feet for that matter, you know. I mean, here we have a lot of mountainous territory. And we have some beautiful, real pretty country as well, but there is also a lot of places, you know, where the foxes do end up going up the side of mountains and stuff. And it's that.
Right.
You know, hammers the crap out of them.
It takes it out of them. Yeah, the terrain. The terrain is such a huge part of what we do. You know, it's I see that a lot with people who import dogs over here.
Right.
You know, and even locally here, you know, if. You know, I've got a hound right now where most of her family is going to come from fairly flat terrain.
Right.
So, you know, she's grown up here, grew up in the terrain, you know, still a youngster, but it's going to be interesting for me to see how she is able to cope here.
Yes. Yeah.
Where the terrain's really rocky. It's extremely steep.
Mm-hmm.
And so far she's doing great, but like ultimately what that's going to look like 7 years from now, if she's going to be, because, you know, that's an issue that I've got with the American Foxhound that I have. Her genetics come from like Texas, New Mexico.
Right. Right.
And, you know, great genetics, but she has not held up to the real rough terrain over here. She's, you know, 8 years old, but looks like she could be 12. I mean, just old and kind of crotchety and weird.
Right.
And, you know, I think that there's something to be said for kind of being aware as you're looking at a pack like yours. I must imagine that must be, you know, something that you have to think about when you're, you know, that aspect of pack dynamics, when you're bringing in breeding animals or when you're kind of choosing what you're going to do, that there's got to be part, an aspect of that being aware of not only did these, are these genetics functioning where they came from, but are they going to function here where I am?
Yeah. 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 I mean, we do have a pretty diverse country, our hunting country. So we're primarily in Albemarle and Orange County. Mm-hmm. But we also hunt some in Louisa County. And one of the areas we hunt in Louisa County is called the Green Springs Historic Area. Mm-hmm. And, it's very flat. It's primarily grazing country. There's a lot of blackjack around there as well, so it can be going. So it's in serious stark comparison to somewhere like where the kennels is here in Keswick, where we have the Southwest Mountains, where you have beautiful rolling hills in the bottom side of it. But excuse me, as you and I well know, you know, foxes under pressure, they're either going to go to ground or they're going to go to the high ground.
Yep.
You know? One or the other. So, oh, yeah. Again, you know, we'll find them in the low ground and they'll play a little bit in the low ground. And then it's like, yeah, heat's getting a little bit too hot here now, time to go. And they'll scurry up that mountain. And, you know, you're literally on the horses. Sometimes you wish you were on a mountain goat, because, I mean, it gets pretty rough up there.
Right.
So you've got very different, very diverse, different countries. And then we have, you know, a few places that we hunt that are somewhere in between.
Right.
So they have to be hounds. The hounds I'm breeding for have to be able to cope with several different types of terrain.
Okay.
And there's a few packs further north of here that breed a more heavier type of hound.
Mm-hmm.
I just find that they're just too hard on themselves in the high ground in the mountains. Okay. You know, and they take, you know, I found that also up in Canada when I was breeding the pack up in Canada. We were primarily running coyotes as opposed to foxes here. Mm-hmm. But I found that one of the primary things with breeding a pack up there is you have such a short season, right? We were doing the same as here, so we're running them on horseback, and that's primarily what I do, right? It's not like a lot of the guys that will be listening today, and they're running them from the back of a truck or whatever. You know, it's a very different type of sport. So we're not running them as soon as the snow starts flying, and up in Canada we'd run them a bit in the snow. You could have what they call snow pads on the horses, because that's the primary problem why a lot of the time you can't run horses in the snow. Is what happens is the snow builds up in the shoes.
Mm-hmm.
So you end, oh, sure. So you end up with a horse that has like stilts on 4 feet, you know, so they can be like, three of them will be like 4 inches higher than the other. And it's a recipe for breaking the horse's leg, right? So it's not, not particularly safe. That, and the other thing is, if it doesn't build up that much, is they can be galloping along, and then all of a sudden the ball that has gathered up in the shoe ends up flipping up and hitting them in the stomach, and then it scares the crap out of them, and then they do goofy shit then, right?
So right.
Another thing you have to be a little bit careful of. But they do make something called a snowshoe. So you shoe them regularly like you would any other horse. But it's like a little rubber dimple in the shoe. I don't know if you've seen it before.
Oh yeah, we've got them there. Standard issue here in Norway.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah. So, I mean, if your horses are shod with snowshoes, it's not too bad. Mm-hmm. But then you're fighting with the guys that are all, you know, they're my philosophy is you got to live and let live and let everyone have their bit of fun. Like, and there was a lot of guys that would run dogs out of trucks, or they'd run them out of snow machines. So I always felt like when, you know, one of the guys, and I was good friends with him, he says, yeah, the coyotes are all yours till the snow starts flying, he says, and then they're fair game for us. And I'm like, yeah, that's fair enough, you know. We all got to get along, like, you know.
Right.
So it made our season fairly short. I mean, basically, we'd start in August, and then if we were extremely lucky, we'd get to November, early December. Makes for a short season. And I always found that the bigger, heavier hounds were just, they took so much longer to mature.
Hmm.
I liked a lighter, more racier, smaller hound that was just, it would mature that much more quicker.
Yeah.
And people would go, oh, well, you know, you're running down coyotes, you need something with a bit of size. And it's like, nah, not really.
Right.
Not really. I mean, some of the nastiest nastiest hounds I've seen on a coyote have been little bitch hounds that were, you know, 35, 40 pounds, like, you know.
Right.
Nasty little things, like, you know.
Right.
And yeah, I've seen some big old dopey looking, you know, 75, 80 pound things that should be able to pick up a coyote and shake it around, and they stand there and bark at it. Like, it's like, yeah, you know. Yeah. So he can always judge a book by his cover. So yeah, I don't want them too heavy.
Mm-hmm.
I think they just beat themselves up if they're too heavy.
Right. Well, I guess, you know, because you're doing most of what you're doing is on horseback. How, when we're kind of talking about maturity level of hounds and things like that, how do you get your young hounds kind of into the pack? Do you have a pack of, like, a puppy pack that you run where they're kind of all on the same level, and you bump them up when they get kind of to an upper level? Or, like, how do you get young hounds into the pack? Because I would assume that they would not be at the same level entering the pack as the rest of the pack.
So how I do it is we start them off, like, we'll pack break them first of all, so that they'll actually pack up with the pack when we're walking them around and stuff like that. So we start that. Right now, we're just coming to the end of the season, and the next 4 or 5 months, we put them on what we call couples. So it's like a dual collar, and we'll couple them to an old hound. And once we give the command to get over or to stop or whatever, that puppy starts to associate it with the command. And then, you know, so once their pack broke, then you're three parts of the way there. Once we've done the pack break inside of things, we'll spend maybe 4 to 6 weeks just chilling. We'll take them for a walk down the road and let them just be hounds. There's a big field there and there's a creek. When we let them play and carry on and chase each other and do all the goofy stuff that puppies do, along with, you know, a lot of the hounds that are second season hounds that were puppies last year, you know, they kind of goof off and do stupid shit. And the old hounds will just go lie under a tree and watch and go, look at them dumbasses running around, kind of thing, you know.
Right.
And then, so they'll probably do that for 4 to 6 weeks. And then we'll progress from that to, to pedal bikes, to push bikes. Mm-hmm. So then we all start on them probably middle of June. We'll start on pedal bikes and we'll take the whole pack. I normally do around, we'll start off slow, but by the time we're ready to start hunting, we'll be up to about 12 to 15 miles on the pedal bikes.
Right.
So it just tightens all of those puppy muscles and feet.
Mm. And How old are they at that point?
So ideally, I mean, I've gotten into a horrible rut the last couple of seasons of bitches have been coming in later and later and later, and pups are getting to a point where ideally I'd like pups to be on the ground now. And the last few times I've had, the last 2 years I've had bitches whelping in June and July, which is awful. I hate that because then you've got pups that are, pardon the terminology, but they're so retarded by August that because we're going to start them hunting in August, so they're barely a year old, and they're just goofy as hell. They just don't know if they're Arthur or Martha. You know, they're just stupid. Right. And I think the type of hounds we're breeding are slightly different. Now, a lot of guys listening now probably run walkers of Julys, and they're running them at 6 and 8 months old, and they're probably running fine. You know, I think the type of hound that we're running is very different, and I think it takes a lot longer for them to both physically and mentally mature.
Right. Right.
So typically we'd want them like kind of on the ground now. So by August, they're 16, 18 months. So they're both physically and mentally just in a good spot.
Sure.
So we'll do that for until the beginning of the season. Now the beginning of the season, we have a tremendous amount of corn around here. So that's normally my go-to spot. I have, you know, I liaise with the landowners and farmers and ask them if they've been seeing foxes and whatnot. And I got a good idea just from being here a while now where the good spots are, where I'm going to hit into foxes. Hmm. And, I just split them up into groups. So, I think we had, what was it, 9 couple of pups this time around. So that was like 18 pups. So I try not to bring too many at one go, but I'll probably bring 6 to 8 pups each morning. So early on in the season, we'll go out 4, sometimes 5 times a week. So we'll go, you know, we'll go 6 o'clock in the morning, we'll meet. And right. We'll go for, you know, a couple of 3 hours. And just rattle around in the cornfields. So basically, the young pups just learn from the older hounds. I mean, you know, you get a chase going in a cornfield, you know, the pups can't help but get sucked into it because it's, right. You know, it's a big adrenaline rush for them. So it's a very easy way for them to get sucked into a chase. So they'll get running in the cornfields, and I just rotate them so that, you know, I've got, you know, this 6 will go today, another 6 will go tomorrow, and just keep rotating them and rotating them. So then, and that's not necessarily on horses. The early season, I'll just go on foot. Just so sometimes if you get pups that are just a little bit shy or whatever, I'll get right in. You can walk in the cornfields with them and get right in the rows and walk in with the corn, right in there with them, and just encourages them to go in there and draw for a fox. So I'll do that for a while and then slowly progress with the horses and then hunt with the horses. And then by September, it's normally Labor Day is when the official, the members can start coming out. They'll come out on the horses in the middle of September. So by then, the pups have got a fairly good grasp on what's going on.
Right, right.
And they generally, for the most part, they're pretty good. They're pretty good. They'll toe the line. I try not to bring, like I say, too many out at one time because I think then they just all start hanging together and start goofing off and doing silly stuff that they ought not to be. So okay. I try to keep it to a bit of a minimum, just like 5-6 pups at a time. Because if you bring too many more than that, like I say, they all just kind of hang together and start. They either do one or two things. They either just hang around beside you, which is kind of infuriating, or they go off looking for trouble.
Sure, that makes sense.
So, you know, I try to minimize, you know, out of, I mean, early on in the season, I'm normally taking quite a lot of hounds because it's just, you know, you want to try and get them out and get as much mileage on them as you can. So, I mean, early on in the season, it's nothing for me to bring 45 hounds out.
Wow. Wow. That's, so that's amazing. That must be.
And of the 45, I mean, there's probably, you know, six of them are puppies. Right. So, you know, it's a good way of getting them going, and it's always worked really well for me. Like, you know, it's very, you know, if the pups aren't sucked into it from that, then probably they're not going to make it.
Sure. Right. That makes sense. You know, you talked about kind of having the harder driving dogs that keep the pressure on the fox, and then you've got the dogs that are, you know,
colder nosed.
Yeah, a little bit colder nosed, better nosed.
Yeah.
Is that something where to maintain a pack with both of those qualities, or with dogs with both of those qualities, do you expect that? Does that happen from a line of dogs where pups are born with kind of varying degrees of those qualities? Or do you actually have to have different lines of dogs for, you know, if you see like, hey, I need a little bit more drive here, next generation,
yeah,
or you have to breed for that? Or do you, like, how does that work as you're kind of putting together your pack?
I think this particular pack has been fairly closely bred. To a point now where I am having to go out a little bit, but okay. I'm very nervous to go out because it's like anything. When you breed fairly tight, you know what you're going to get. It's a known quantity. And when you start going and out crossing, it's always a bit of a gamble. And sometimes it's a good gamble and sometimes it's really not a particularly good one, you know?
Right.
They share a lot of blood within, I would say there's probably four or five main families within my pack.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough. It's a constant struggle for me to try and keep enough diversity between still keeping it from within this kennel, but giving it enough diversity. So I have to try. And sometimes if like people think, oh, you just throw a dog with a bitch and we got pups and away you go. I like to look at pedigrees and say, all right, well, sometimes you can have too much of a good thing.
Hmm.
So you see it a lot of the times, people are like, oh, that was a phenomenal dog. And everyone, you know, whether it's like a coonhound guy or a bear guy or a coyote guy, you know, and everyone breeds to it and you breed and breed and breed and breed and breed. You get to a point where you can't get away from that blood.
Yeah.
And although it was good blood, you can have too much of a good thing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So it may sound easy breeding, but it's quite not difficult, but you have to be very cognizant of what's in a pedigree and
how much
of a certain line you want in there.
Right.
I mean, I had the beauty of, I knew the guy I took over from, knew him for 20 years. So I knew a lot of the hounds that are in these pedigrees and I knew their strengths and weaknesses. So that gave me a good heads up and a bit of a, you know, if I'd come in here and hadn't known any of that, it would be a bit more of a gamble.
Right.
But I mean, I've just bred a bitch this time around, to a dog from up in, the Piedmont Foxhounds up in Northern Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And that line is of the same bloodlines, but it's, he brought the guy that hunts him up there, a guy called Joe Tex, good guy. He brought it in from Texas. And okay. that was some blood that went out to Texas like 35, 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the packs we have here in this Eastern Seaboard that are breeding this type of hound that we have here, we're all kind of, you know, there's a lot of similar blood there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's enough diversity to keep things going, but there is a lot of similar blood. So this time round, I kind of chatted with Jordan and chatted him about what good dogs he had. And he showed me this dog, and he said, yeah, the pedigree's interesting on this dog, and it goes back to some stuff that's in Texas. So I thought, well, you know what it is? Let's give that a whirl. So I bred one of my bitches to this dog.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing about it is that line is on the bitches side of things. So on the top side of that breeding is some of our blood. So I'm kind of hoping it's going to nick in quite nicely. It's got an outcross, but it's also got some blood from here as well. So it should, hopefully, I mean, you know, that's how it goes with breeding, but you know, it might give me just a little bit more genetic diversity but at the same time, not go so far as, you know, it might make it just a little bit less of a gamble.
Right. I mean, you've got dogs in there that, you know, are kind of a known entity.
Yes, exactly. So, and the bitch aside, you know, I mean, one of the things, it's like I was chatting before, like I like a more lighter framed hound.
Hmm.
And a slightly smaller hound, which I think my predecessor did too. But that's almost to a detriment, because I don't know how you feel about that kind of stuff, but I find if you breed small to small, it only ever gets smaller.
I find that to be the case with the males.
Right.
If I'm breeding to small males, I'm going to get small males. But it's the darndest thing. My experience has been that if I've bred to big males, even if I've bred to a smaller female, I tend to maintain the size.
See, I find the opposite here. I find that the size definitely comes from my bitches.
Really? Like, interesting.
I have a bitch here right now. And she's tiny, and I'd love to breed from her. But my biggest problem is, where do I go? I actually am saying I tried breeding. I tried putting a bigger dog on her, and I don't know whether it was just not meant to be. I tried breeding her, and the dog couldn't get to her at all. Couldn't get hung on her. Okay. And I guess I could have gone the AI route, I suppose. But I do tend to find the opposite of what you're finding. I tend to find my size does come from the bitches.
Really? That's interesting. And I mean, it should be said that my experience breeding is from the sled dogs. So it's a different type of dog.
Yeah. Yeah. Possibly. I don't know. This particular Texas line, the bitches are a lot bigger. So I'm kind of hoping that maybe it might. I'm kind of painting myself into a bit of a hole. I have, you know, some wonderful bitches, but they're just getting a little too small.
Right.
You know, they're getting a little bit whippety. And, you know, when it's not like we're hunting hours upon hours upon hours, but I find when you get them just a little bit too fine that you start losing an element of stamina there. So that's kind of my thinking behind that breed. And so, you know, it's like everything, it could bite me in the ass, you know, I don't know. But I guess it's only one way we're going to find out.
Right. I mean, you have to do something. So
I bred two of the bitches that are good known quantities and out of good, really solid bitches and good dogs. So, you know, if this litter turns out to be an absolute crapshoot, then at least I've got the other two litters to fall back on.
Right.
To pick up the mainstay. But yeah, this season I seem to have, I don't know why, I guess it's just how it's rolled out, but like I was saying earlier on, I think we've drafted more older hounds that have just aged out. I retired a couple. One of our members, she has a little wiener dog, and she was desperate for a retired foxhound. So I gave her an old bitch, and she posted a picture of it on Facebook, and she's got the little wiener dog lying next to it. Me being the smart ass that I am, I'm like, well, you know, it is 2024, and if a girl wants a hairy wiener, she can have herself a hairy wiener. So I'm like, oh, God. Like, you know, I might have opened up a bit of a can of worms there.
Right.
but yeah, we've drafted quite a few older ones this time around, but I think to be – you need – you need experience in your pack for sure. But sometimes, you know, if you keep that experience around for too long, it can be a detriment to the pack.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that that's the case with, you know, when you're working with anything, any type of working dog where you're not working with just the individual, you know, where it's not, you know, you're working one-on-one. You know, because then you can afford to slow down the pace. It doesn't matter. But like a team, you know, a pack situation like you have, or like the bear hunters have, or, you know, some of these dry ground lion guys have.
Yes.
Or the sled dogs guys have, you know, I mean, you're only going to be as fast as your slowest dog. And naturally, your slowest dog is probably going to be one of your older ones.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, that. It's a trade-off where, you know, you've got the older ones are going to bring the experience and the ability to kind of, you know, roll with the punches that the younger dogs are just not going to have. But, you know, at the same time, it's kind of, you hit a point where it becomes kind of an issue of diminishing returns where, yeah, they can get everything done, but it's just going to be so slow that it doesn't actually make a difference.
I mean, like yesterday, I got a dog there. His name is Ozzy. And he's probably the biggest dog I have in the kennel. He's got a head on him like a bucket. I mean, he's everything what I've just said that I like in a hound. He's the opposite. He's like 80 or 90 pounds. And like I said, a head like a rhinoceros. And amazingly, he's entered, I think maybe he might be a year older. Year younger than the Remus dog I was talking about. And typically, I would think of him being like, you know, 8 or 9 or whatever he is, as being done by now, you know, because he's so big and heavy.
Sure.
But that son of a gun is still he's in better shape than the smaller, lighter frame dog, which absolutely genuinely has shocked me. But yesterday, you know, they got going and. I think if you go back and look at the video of that first video I sent you, there's two hounds come along the lower side and you can hear two big, deep chop voices. Boop, boop, boop. He's one of those dogs. I mean, phenomenal dog. And he pretty much, him and the other dog that's with him is a dog called Captain. And the pair of them started that hunt off and got going. And without him, would they have found it? Probably, but he was the one that got going. But when we got back, we count the hounds in couples, right? So we'll say like yesterday I had 15 and a half couple, which is, you know, 31 hounds.
Right. Yep.
So I were coming back and I counted off and I said we had 15 couple, we were half light. So I pulled it up on the GPS and there was Ozzy back where we originally found that fox dicking around on the side of the thing, on the side of the riverbank. And I'm calling and calling, and he basically, I mean, he was a good ways away, so he probably couldn't have heard me anyway. But basically, you know, we got the metaphorical finger, you know, screw you, good luck.
Sure.
So I sent one of the guys back. I said, look, I said to Gavin, I gave him the GPS and my phone. I said, here, go and get Ozzy and bring him back. I said, I'll meet you back at the trailers. We get back to the trailers and still no Gavin. So Mike, who's my kennelman, and Tony Ann, the girl that runs the barn, they went off and I said, go and find Gavin. If you can find Gavin, grab Ozzy off of them, throw him in the back of the truck and come on. I said, it's taking too long. 15 minutes later, still nothing. I'm like, oh, for crying out loud. So then I just radio over. I say, have you got Ozzy? No, he's still dicking around on the side of the riverbank. I'm like, all right, just all of you's come back. I'll go get him. And I physically had to go get him, you know. And that's the trade-off, right? He's an independent, right. You know, he thinks he knows better. He's, you know, he just, you know, he needed a kick in the ass, really, to be honest.
But right.
That's when that. But the days when that refusal to just quit, and it was probably just old drag lines that were already there from where we found it first thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just dicking around on that. And it's like, dude, come on. Like, you know.
Right.
My prime example of just being a detriment. Like, I mean, I'd have liked to have just got them all back home and away we go. But no, I ended up spending 45 minutes or an hour going and trying to find his sorry ass.
Right.
It's kind of the classic, nobody's perfect, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said to the boss this morning, I was chatting to one of the bosses and I said, look, you know, Remus and Ozzy, they'll probably do the earlier part of next season and they'll be crucial in getting next season's puppies going. But after that, we'll probably draft them down to Melissa down in South Carolina.
Yeah.
Because, gotcha. You know, they're just becoming, just a hindrance, you know?
Right.
So, you know, it's every dog has its day, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, it's.
I mean, I sent her a dog earlier on this season, and he was a pup, and all his siblings were doing fine. But for some reason or other, this dog was, he just couldn't work out fences. He get stuck behind the fence and he'd be roaring the bloody house down, going berserk. And I'm like, oh, I swear to God, I was going to shoot him. Like, I mean, you know, they'd find a fox and, you know, all the rest of the pack are either over the fence or under the fence and gone. And he's standing there cooking up a storm on the side of the fence. And I'm like, I'm done with this crap. Like, and Melissa is, like I said, she's in Pinewood Forest. There's no fences at all.
Yep.
And I said to her, I said, look, this is the deal. I said, he's a young dog. He's broke. He won't mess around with deer. He's deer broke. I said, he has the potential to be a good dog. I said, but I can't deal with that. Like, he's doing my head in. Like, he's got to go. Okay. And she said, we don't have any real fences down here. So, yeah, he'll slot in great. I said, well, I'm being honest with you. This is his fault. You know? And I spoke to her a couple of weeks ago. He's one of her best young hounds that she has. He's doing great.
Yep.
So, you know, just horses for courses, I suppose.
You know, and it's kind of bringing it back to what we were talking about before. You know, it's you know, the pack dynamics and building a pack, you've got to kind of have to, it's not just as simple as getting the number, you know. You can't put whatever 45 hounds together and expect it to work. You've got to have... You know, you've got to have a plan, not just in how you're going to train them, how you're going to incorporate them into the pack as they age and also as they age out, but, you know, also how, you know, the breeding and, you know, everything. It's such a huge task, which is why I wanted to talk to you about it, because I know that, you know, it's, you know, a huge, huge part of what you do.
Well, I think the one beauty about it is we have a lot of, like, being a member of the Master of Foxhounds Association of America, we have a really, really good resource in that they have an online stud book.
Mm.
So I could geek out all night just going into pedigrees, and I can just sit there and you can pull up to, like, I think it's up to 7 or 8 generations.
Wow.
Just on the screen at one time. So
cool.
And yeah, you can read all day looking at pedigrees. I mean, you have to look at the complete picture, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of people that have tried just breeding from pedigrees, and you think, oh, you know, and on paper, this should be absolutely phenomenal, and it's junk, you know?
I've done that myself.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we all have, to be honest.
I think we all have.
Yeah. 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 You look at it and you go, God, these things are going to be dynamite. Yeah. You know, and it's like, wah, wah, just... Yeah,
exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
If only it was just that, you know. I guess that's how you end up with all these racehorse guys, you know, and they put $10 million horses to another $10 million horse, and then you end up with $1,000 claimers, you know?
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we had a horse here when we first came here. He was they paid $1 million for him as a yearling.
Wow.
And there he was at Keswick Hunt Club, and he was crap at that as well. He didn't end up staying. He was absolutely gutless. He was a good looking horse. I mean, look at him and think, well, shit, yeah, you can see why they paid $1 million for him. He is a gorgeous looking horse. Absolutely useless. Absolutely useless. So there's your, you know, I think he was bred by, I can't remember what his sire was, but I mean, you know, if they sold him for $1 million, they'd probably, you know, somebody spent probably $250,000 on the jump for to get him, like, you know.
Right. Yeah.
And now you have $1,000 claiming horse. It's like,
oh my gosh.
How do you start off with how do you get $1 million in the horse racing world? Start off with 10.
Yeah, right. Right. Nine.
You know, I think it's basically those big boys, it's a tax write off because nobody can afford to hemorrhage money doing that kind of game.
No. It's no, I don't think so. But yeah.
If it can happen in racehorses, it's just as easy to happen in hounds or any other dog, you know?
Yep. Absolutely. I can.
The old saying, breed the best of the best and hope for the best, is about as good as it gets.
It is. And, you know, I think that's usually that's going to give you the best chance of success. But at the same time, it's no guarantee. It's no guarantee.
I mean, I've bred some phenomenal, like, you look, just take away the pedigree on them and you look at them and go, this hound is just dynamite. This hound's dynamite. And yet again, you know, just puppies are absolute junk, you know, garbage. But yeah, that's the weird genetics. I mean, I bred from a bitch here, two different sires. The one sire I used, all the pups were absolutely phenomenal. Mm. I bred it to a different dog 2 years later, not worth a light. Yeah. Absolute junk. The dog I used was still a very, very good dog, but just that mix just didn't work.
Yeah. Didn't work. I mean, that's the thing, is sometimes you can breed two absolutely phenomenal animals and they just, the combination is just not going to do it.
No.
Which is super frustrating. It is.
But at the same time, it's also, I think it's what keeps us ticking away and keeps us awake at night as well.
It is.
You
know,
it keeps you, if it was that easy, I think I probably would have lost interest by now.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah, no, same here. It's endlessly, endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, I was chatting to the boss earlier on today, and I was like, you know, I'm talking about stuff, and I said, look, every day is a school day. Like, the day you're not learning is the day you're dead.
Boy,
and anyone who says otherwise is just, really, if they're full of their own self-importance, if they think, you know, they've got it off pat and know what the game is, yeah, no. I'm certainly not that arrogant. Like I said, it's every day I learn something new.
Well, that's what keeps me in it, though, right? You know, it's like, at least for me, that's what keeps me in it. As you said, if I'd figured all this out from the get-go, I would have lost interest a long time ago. So,
I mean, I'm at it. This is coming into my 30th season doing this.
Yeah,
and it still intrigues me and frustrates me like the first year I came into it. You know?
Right.
And that's just at the Foxhound game. I mean, I've had dogs since I was a kid. I was breeding terriers when I was like 12, 13.
Right.
You know, so it just, yeah. I think you either have a passion for this or you don't. And if you don't have a passion, then forget about it.
Get out of it. Find something else to do.
Yeah, become a crazy cat person or something.
Exactly. Exactly. Because the world needs more of those. Well, I really appreciate you coming on, Paul. It was good to talk to you again. I feel like it's been a little, I always enjoy talking to you. We talked for a good long time before we even started the podcast.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
I appreciate you offering to have me back on. It's always good to chat to like-minded folks. And
yeah, Absolutely.
I mean, some people might think I'm talking a load of tosh, but hopefully there's a few people that might make them think a little bit.
Well, I mean, that's a little bit like we were talking about before. You know, it's there's something to be said of whether you agree with everything you've said or whether you disagree with everything, you know, you've said. If nothing else, hopefully it'll make them think and, you know, at least think through what they're doing. And if they disagree with you, hopefully they'll take the time to actually think about why, if nothing else.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a big, bad world. And you know, that's what makes the world spin is diversity and people's different opinions. Just like you said, just because you don't agree with somebody doesn't mean to say it's right or wrong. And that's one thing I have learned in the dog game is there's always 15 different ways to do the same thing.
There's a lot of roads to know to roam. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of them work and some of them may work for some people, but it may not necessarily work for me. That doesn't mean to say it's wrong. You know, it just doesn't work for me.
Right.
And like I say, I'm not so arrogant to realize that, you know, this every day is a different day. And I think as dog people, I think you can always garner information and knowledge from other people from different facets of life and different realms of dog world or horse world or whatever. I mean, you know, it's there is a lot of good, valid stuff that people kind of get a little bit close-minded to things. And, you know, I think they do themselves a disservice by not being a little bit more open-minded, because the way I look at it is if you can do something easier, I mean, it's that whole saying, like, you know, work smarter, not harder.
Yep.
Or if you can find and devise a way of doing something easier, then why the hell not?
Right.
Oh, you get a lot of, it's one thing I've found since I live in Virginia, and we go like, well, why do you do it that way? Oh, it's the Virginia way. We've always done it that way.
Yeah.
But we could do it this way and this way, and it would make life a whole pile easier. Oh, no, no, no. We like to, it's almost like they're, you know, it's like, you know, it's, you know, some kind of, you know, I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's just sometimes it's just like making certain kind of trails of thought just get into people's heads. Sure.
Why do you do it? Why do you do it? Because it's always been done that way.
Yeah, that's a classic. Oh, we've always done it that way. It's like, well, have you ever thought there might be a better way of doing it?
Right.
You know, and that's not to say that you need to do it the way I'm doing it. Maybe a hybrid version of the way I do it and the way you do it might make it way more streamlined, you know?
Right.
But,
yeah. Absolutely.
I hope people can just, you know, think about things like you say, and if it is, even if you do horribly disagree with what I've said, is, you know, just make you think why you think the way you do.
Right. Yep.
And is there potentially another better way of doing it?
Yep.
You know?
No, absolutely.
I think it. We owe it to our dogs to give them, when you go into breeding something, you have to do your due diligence. You've got to think about why the hell you're breeding this. What are they bringing to the table?
Yep.
You know? And I think a lot of guys will just breed to something just because it's next door.
Just because it's there, yeah.
It's convenient. And that's not, you shouldn't do that. Nor on the other end of the extreme is, you know, this dog is flavor of the month. It's won this, and this. We should breed to it. Because that's just as bad as breeding to the dog next door as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You flood the stud books, or not the stud books, but, you know, you flood the population with
too much of the same genetics.
Too much of the same thing, yeah.
Exactly. You get I think they call it popular stud syndrome or something. They call it something like that. It is.
Yep.
And it that's not good either. Like, so, I mean, you have to just look at the characteristics of the female and look at the characteristics of the male, and you have to look at the pedigrees as well. And it all has to, you know, try and align as much as you can.
Yep.
You know.
Absolutely. Well, I can hear someone knocking on your door, and I can hear your pup whining to get out. So
yeah.
I'm going to let you go.
All right. Well, good chat to you again, Brad.
Likewise, Paul. Thanks for coming on.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
I am buying you for a day.
Man, I love that sound.